This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Because renewable costs are coming down, you know, if I look forward about the energy mix, where do we get our electricity from? Where do we get our energy from? It's very exciting.
Have you ever driven by a hillside covered with wind turbines and wondered, who owns those? And is the energy produced up there making it to my house? Chances are those turbines are not owned by your local or statewide energy utility company, but by an independent power producer, or IPP, an important but often overlooked area of the American energy industry. This week's guest on Sea Change Radio is Todd Thorner, an entrepreneur who started and operated multiple renewable energy companies himself, from wind to solar to hydroelectric. Thorner tells us about the path that wind energy takes from the hillside to your home. We also discuss how IPPs fit into the energy mix, how they interface with utility companies, and why they may represent the best hope for a flexible pivot away from coal and gas toward clean and renewable electricity. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Todd Thorner. He's the founder and CEO of JTN Energy. Todd, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks very much, Alex.
So you're a serial entrepreneur in the renewable energy space. You've started up wind companies, solar, and even hydro. One common thread throughout your four companies in the renewable space is the independent power producer, the IPP. Why don't you explain to our listeners what they are?
Yeah, so the electric power industry in the U.S., you know, for the last century or so has been under a monopolistic model where utilities have territories and they basically generate electricity, they transmit it, and then they distribute it. And then back in the late 70s with the oil shocks, there was a law called PURPA, which opened up the generation portion of the electric power industry to competition. So essentially, you know, the door was open for renewable generators. If you could match the price that the utility would otherwise pay, you could basically secure a contract to sell your renewable electricity to the incumbent electric utility provider. And so that's when we had this first wave in the IPP industry, independent power producer industry. There was cogeneration using steam heat. There was wind, solar, hydro. You know, that first go-around didn't last too long. It went through the 80s, and then when the cost of power dropped significantly during the Reagan years, a lot of the support and subsidies were pulled back, the price of power dropped, and so that whole industry went dormant for about 10, 15 years. And so when I came on the scene after graduate school in 1997 from Johns Hopkins SAIS in Washington, D.C., and looked out at the marketplace, I could see that in Europe, wind power had grown up. It had taken off. Basically, the Europeans had taken the technology that was advanced here in the United States back in the early 80s, and they'd scaled it up. They'd scaled up the business models around it, and there were large utility-scale wind assets across Europe being developed. So when I looked out in the marketplace in the late 90s to see where were the opportunities to try to support and advance renewable energy, you know, I looked at all the different technologies, and really it was utility scale wind that was the technology that from an economic perspective looked like it was competitive or close to competitive with conventional fuels and fossil fuels here in the U.S. And so that's really why I focused first on wind and co-founded Foresight Wind Energy in 2002. And at that point, you know, there weren't a lot of opportunities to jump into solar or jump into all these other areas that have really blossomed in recent years just based on the economics improving. And so at Foresight Wind, we developed utility scale wind power projects, the types you see in TV commercials all the time right now, very large machines out in a remote location. Did all the entitlement work, the land work, the environmental studies, wind studies, and basically put together a package that would allow the facility to
to be built and constructed. And then we basically would sell those entitlements to a larger IPP, independent power producer company, that actually had the balance sheet or the borrowing ability to build a $200-300 million facility.
So over the last 15, 20 years, how has the independent power producer model shifted? And if you can give us an idea of what percentage roughly it comprises compared to the utilities in this country.
I would guess that the amount of energy coming from independent power producers is probably in the 30 to 40% range, pretty significant portion. It varies significantly kind of state by state and utility territory by utility territory.
What kind of states have a higher percentage off the top of your head? Is it one that has more regulation or less?
You know, it's a question of deregulation. So in California, we went through a botched deregulation process. The main thrust of deregulation in the utility sector is opening up that generation component of the business. And so in California, we took a shot at it back around 2000. There are elements of that deregulation effort that were problematic and so obviously caused a lot of problems. But some states still have not gone through deregulation process. They still are following pretty much an older business type model without a centralized marketplace for buying and selling electricity. It's really the utilities in those marketplaces that are controlling the contracting and the selling of power.
So not all these IPPs are renewable, correct?
That's right. So IPP is any independent power producer, a private company that comes in.
So you could have a coal plant.
That's
and that
right.
Could be an IPP.
They could be. And if, you know, happily, there are no coal plant IPPs currently and people having a hard time keeping existing coal plants operating. But, you know, there's a large portion of the IPP industry currently is natural gas power plant developers.
About what percentage? More than half are natural gas?
Yeah, I'd say probably half are natural gas. If you look at all the new power plants that are being built in the country, I'd say, you know, at least half of them are being built by IPPs. You know, sometimes the incumbent utility will build something, but oftentimes the state regulator will require the utility to demonstrate that it has, you know, reasonable economics to do that, or they'll, you know, put out a solicitation to see if the private industry can do it at a cost lower than what the utility can do it for.
So Todd, you mentioned in some of your earlier companies, Foresight Wind and Solar, the exit strategy, so to speak, was to sell to these larger independent power producers. I imagine, though, that some of these independent power producers, the IPPs, get swallowed up by utilities, public utilities, or are they completely discrete from each other?
No, they're discrete from each other. And in fact, the state regulators basically give utilities a mandate and allow them to earn a certain return, but they don't allow those types of regulated utilities to go out and buy up independent power producers. They, in fact, want them separate because they're trying to encourage competition around the pricing of wholesale electric power.
I see. And do the IPPs sell some of their electricity to the utilities? Or if you're a small rancher, you're producing wind on your property, where are some of the avenues that energy would be delivered?
When it comes to power plants, there's a big division on how you sell the electricity based on the size of the project and how you interconnect to the electrical system. And so if it's a small facility that might meet some local loads on the ranch or in the area, and you basically can connect behind the meter, and that's subject to California state rules and Rule 21. If you're going to do a large facility, what they call utility scale facility, which would be, you know, many large turbines or dozens or hundreds of wind turbines, for example, or, you know, many acres of solar panels, that's a utility scale project. And those typically are plugged in at a higher voltage level that can accommodate pushing more electrons through it. And typically that you're, you know, doing a contract directly with the utility. And so if you're a small rancher, that would be a net metering type deal under a standard contract, similar to how people do solar on their roofs here in California. But if you were to do a large facility, you know, if you're in Wyoming and you have 30,000 acres and a company comes in, an IPP company like Foresight Wind, develops a project for 100 megawatt project, say, you know, 40 or 50 large turbines, each one that can provide electricity for, you know, 300-400 homes, a couple thousand people. That type of project basically is subject to federal Energy Regulatory Commission rules around open access. Basically, the utilities have to allow you to plug into the transmission system, and they have to offer you a fair rate for the electricity that you're selling.
So a lot of this probably sounds like a foreign language to our listeners, but that's kind of what JTN Energy's mandate is to try to help these IPPs wend their way through these labyrinthian regulatory hurdles and understand a very complex and evolving industry.
Exactly. It can sound like gobbledygook. I try to keep the acronyms out of it, but
I appreciate that.
It's interesting that Europeans generally have national electrical marketplaces. And of course, you know, there's different rules in different countries in Europe. But when Europeans come to the U.S., for example, when Foresight Wind was scaling up and we had a significant portfolio of development projects, we wanted to partner with a larger company with experience in wind that would have assets to support our growing portfolio and efforts. And there were a lot of European companies at the time coming to the U.S. They had great experience with wind development in Europe. But coming to the U.S. was very daunting for them because there's this 50-state market. Since every state has its own rules, its own utilities, its own dynamics, its own renewable portfolio standards around what targets and what technologies qualify and what technologies don't qualify, it's a very complex market for outsiders to come. And for us here in the U.S., it's a complex market.
Don't let the sun catch you crying, crying at my front door. You done daddy dirty, he sure don't want you no more. Don't let the sun catch you lying.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to Todd Thorner. He's the founder and CEO of JTN Energy. Why don't you explain how hydroelectric power fits within the renewable world, within the context of IPPs? For example, you go by Niagara Falls, you see an enormous hydroelectric effort underway. That is not an independent power producer, I'm imagining.
No, not at all. So hydroelectric is the first renewable energy technology. You know, it was largely responsible for a lot of the industrialization of this country. And still in New England, if you go along the rivers there's mill towns and you see the old powerhouses. Some of those ones are, you know, just now being repowered with new technology. And hydroelectric to this day provides more renewable electricity, more carbon-free electricity, I should say, than any other renewable technology, wind and solar included. But a lot of the hydroelectric that was developed in the early part of the 20th century involved damming giant rivers to create catchment areas and have had, you know, significant negative environmental impacts from on fish to habitat to actually the carbon impacts of having these large catchment areas in the production of CO2. And so there is a distinction in hydro, and sadly, you know, the public doesn't really get their heads wrapped around it, but there's large existing hydro, and then there's this whole new opportunity around smart, clean, environmentally sensitive hydro. And the types of hydroelectric projects that I focused on have basically been in existing man-made infrastructure. We have the Sierras. The Sierras, during the winter time, half the year, less nowadays with the drought, but there's snow, there's water. It goes from the Sierras basically, you know, out through the Golden Gate, and there's hundreds, thousands of miles of canals and infrastructure that uses that water, and there's big elevation changes as it goes from the Sierras, basically, you know, is used in the Central Valley or out to the sea. And so there's a lot of opportunities to put hydro generators into existing man-made infrastructure where you already have a drop, you already have an elevation change, and essentially you can just build a penstock, pull the water, put it through a generator, and put it back in. It's a non-consumptive use. You're not impacting fish, you're not building in some pristine environment, you're just capturing energy which currently is just dissipating into the air, and instead converting it into electrical energy and selling it as renewable energy.
And in terms of environmental impact, how do some of these smaller hydroelectric efforts that we're talking about differ from a utility scale hydroelectric plant?
Well, you know, I can tell you now that building new hydro plants in the United States that involve damming a natural stream or river and creating a catchment area, I mean, that the majority of the non-carbon energy in the U.S. being generated right now comes from those types of facilities. But those types of facilities were largely built in the post-war period, in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, with, you know, Bonneville Power Administration up in the Northwest. They wanted to bring aluminum smelting and industry to that region, and they could generate low-cost electricity. So they basically, you know, dammed up rivers, and they're generating a low-cost non-carbon energy. I don't think there are going to be any new large hydroelectric projects like that built in this country. And in fact, even internationally, there's significant efforts to try to stop those types of developments. You know, the multilateral development banks, for example, are for the most part shifting away from funding those types of development efforts in the developing world.
But these small scale ones are still expanding.
Essentially, you know, the opportunity is to put in hydro generation in places where you're going to have a very small or negligible environmental impact. And in this country, the opportunity is largely around existing infrastructure. There are 80,000 dams in this country, and only 3% of those dams have hydro generation on them. So there's tens of thousands of dams where, you know, there's water behind it, and it's for whatever operational reason, they're holding the water back, water's let through it, where you could potentially put in an electric generator.
Private industry could go into a state-owned dam and make a bid on producing power from this already existing structure?
Yeah, that's the general idea. Now, how a private company goes to get rights to do the development work and to actually build and operate a facility depends largely on who's the owner of the facility. Is it a state facility? Is it a federal facility? The Army Corps of Engineers owns and operates a lot of dams. Once you engage with a federal agency, it gets more challenging. It takes a lot of time. Hydro is generally, hydroelectric power is regulated at the federal level by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC. And so it basically creates some challenges around dealing just with bureaucracy and timelines of getting permissions to do it. But, you know, I expect that this is going to be an important source of renewable energy going forward as folks in Washington basically update the rules and continue to try to promote and support deploying hydroelectric on those types of existing facilities.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Todd Thorner. He's the founder and CEO of JTN Energy, and he's also the founder of renewable energy companies like Foresight Wind, Foresight Solar, and Cascade Hydro. So, Todd, you've seen a couple decades of the independent power producer market develop. Where do you see it evolving further? Is it expanding the wind, solar, and hydro areas, or do you see other new sources of generation exciting you as well?
Well, the independent power producer industry, I think, is a very exciting place to be right now. The industry has been around for a while, but the unique value that the IPP industry brings is its ability and its interest in pursuing and exploiting new technologies. So, 10, 20 years ago, the IPPs were all developing coal and natural gas. And when the wind industry started growing in this country, when the solar industry started ramping up, it wasn't the incumbent utilities, the investor-owned utilities, that went out and had the capabilities and the expertise to try to deploy these new technologies. What they did was they turned to the IPP industry and said, we have these renewable portfolio standards that are placed on us. We're required to generate a certain percentage of our electricity from clean renewable sources. And so, where are we going to get that? Is PG&E going to go out and by itself try to develop a wind farm? Instead, what they've typically done is they've turned to the IPP industry, and they basically have an RFP, a request for proposals type structure. It's quite common in the industry where they'll put out a bid and say, we want so many megawatts of wind or so many megawatt hours of energy from clean sources, and they'll let the market respond. And because it's a competitive process and you have a lot of different IPPs with different capabilities and experience, they'll respond and they'll do what Foresight Wind and Foresight Solar did, which was, lease the land and do the studies and do the environmental work and come up with a cost model and basically offer to the utility to build a facility and to sell the renewable electric output from that facility for whatever the utility wants, 10 years or 20 years or whatever the contract is.
How much do you think the regulations that are being put in now to try to reduce carbon emissions are spurring competition within the IPP and the utilities, and how much is it just market economics with the IPPs starting to get the utilities to see that their way might not be the only way?
Yeah, I mean, what's exciting is that the IPPs are the organizations that have the flexibility and the intellectual capital and the appetite to pursue renewables. And renewables, because the cost of renewables has been coming down so significantly over the last 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, it's just a constant downward cost curve. The intellectual capability to structure projects, to develop projects, it's largely in the IPP industry. Regulated utilities really are not pursuing development of renewable assets. They've tried it. Here in California, some of the utilities basically got approval to go out and develop solar projects in their territory. And the Public Utility Commission here in California split the target. Whatever the capacity was, this much, they said, let's do half of it is utility owned and half of it we'll put to the independent power producers and let them bid on it. And what happened was that the independent power producers' cost was so much lower than what it cost the utilities to try to do the same thing that the Public Utility Commission pulled the plug on the utility development model and said, let's take all this target capacity and put it out to the marketplace, because the marketplace, the IPPs, are just much more competitive and capable of putting forward the product at a lower price. And because renewable costs are coming down, if I look forward about the energy mix, where do we get our electricity from? Where do we get our energy from? It's very exciting. The cost of wind has been reduced by 85% over the last 25 years. Solar is on a similar cost curve, to the point where it's not just a matter of taking a lower cost product and plugging it into the existing system. The low cost of these products is changing the system. It's getting people to start thinking about, what is the right regulatory model? What is the power mix? Where should we be? California's governor, Jerry Brown, earlier this year came out and announced that he'd like California's renewable portfolio standard target to increase. It's currently, the target is 33% by 2020, and he's proposed 50% by 2030.
this standard, basically it came out in 2002, I think it was when it was first passed. The target was much lower. I forget if it was 20% originally. 2006, it was bumped up. 2011, it was expanded from just the investor-owned utilities to all electric utilities in California. And so, you know, the target has continually been bumped up. And that is an experience which is common throughout the U.S. People are worried about putting these mandates in place, you know, while they're competitive and they come up with the lowest cost of renewable energy, it's the government, you know, directing utilities to procure clean energy. And people are worried that, you know, the cost will be too high and electric rates will go up. But what we found is, as the cost of renewable energy has come down, is the IPP industry has grabbed onto these technologies and shifted much of its focus to renewables. The cost of these technologies has come down and down, which has allowed the regulators to continue to increase the targets without having a negative impact on electricity. And what we're finding is that by signing long-term wind contracts and by signing long-term solar contracts, the utilities are actually creating a hedge against future fuel price increases for natural gas or coal. And so if you look at the percentage, you know, the fuel mix of our country nationally, when I got out of graduate school in the late 90s, our electric system, I think, was 56% coal. It's now, I think, down to around 40% coal. And so that's just in the last, you know, 15, 20 years or so. And that trend is increasing. And now with Obama's climate action plan, the EPA has basically determined that carbon dioxide is a pollutant. It's resulting in climate change, global warming. And so they're rolling out the Clean Power Plan, which is going to be, I think the target is a 30% reduction of CO2 below 2005 levels. And so basically all these concerns about climate change, around pollution related to fossil fuels, will continue to drive these trends. And so, you know, we're going to see increased growth in this country of solar and of wind and small hydroelectric, a number of different technologies. You know, I think the largest capacity contributions, the largest energy contributions long term are probably going to come from solar. Wind power, I think, is still a little bit less expensive in the best, windiest places, but the cost curve of solar is just coming down and down and down. And so, you know, looking out, you know, 5, 10, 15 years from now, I see the wind industry and the solar industry just continuing to improve their economics and to take up a larger and larger share of the total energy mix. And increasingly, coal plants will be retired and, you know, some gas will be built to help support and balance the system, since wind and solar are intermittent. And really the big wild card is what happens with storage technologies and storage costs.
Todd Thorner, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Great, Alex. Thanks a lot.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Bomb the Bass, Ray Charles, and Jaco Pastorius.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.